Being beleaguered goes with the territory at the Department of Infrastructure, but relatively new DOI Minister Michelle Hayward is doing her best to get on the front foot. Government has had limited success in dealing with the housing crisis, but Minister Hayward suggests her plan for a housing agency will succeed where government has so far collectively failed. Russian MHK Michelle Hayward joins me now in the studio. You are here to talk about housing, and we'll come on to that shortly, but there's a couple of things that have been in the news recently. We'll start with the first one, trees. Your department is effectively changing a long-standing position where DOI maintained the trees on the roadside. That has pretty much been the case since we've had roadsides. You're now saying, and probably you have some justification in saying this, that it is the responsibility of the owners of those trees to maintain them.
Yep, exactly that. The legal responsibility rests with the landowner, and you are right. In the past, the department has put considerable resources into managing trees and managing the risk of those trees and what they present to the highways. We don't have the staff to keep doing that anymore. For everyone who complains about government headcount and how many people government employs, the cuts that have happened over the years and the positions that we've just not filled when people have left, I mean that we are, you know, trying to do more now with less staff than we've ever had. And the reality is that we'll have to concentrate our resources on what we're statutorily obliged to provide. And the nice-to-have services like we'll come along and trim the trees for you just aren't sustainable within the department at the moment.
Would it have been better, though, to perhaps have been a bit clearer about that this, the fact that this really is a change in policy, certainly in terms of what the precedent that has been set over probably centuries, let alone decades?
The information's been quite clear. It's been a long time this campaign's coming. One of the drivers for this is that we know when we hit winter storms, we will see a number of trees come down. The winter storms are getting more extreme, the wind gusts get stronger, and the storms often come from a direction that the trees are not used to as well. So we see significant tree loss if we get a storm that comes in perhaps from the northeast rather than our usual southwest. All of those, we have a heat map of where trees are going to endanger our major routes, and we spend a lot of time during those storm responses basically trying to keep major routes open so we can make sure that emergency vehicles can get through, because things like heart attacks in people's homes don't wait for when the storm's finished. And so you need to ensure that we can get access to communities and we can try and keep people safe as much as we can. What we've noticed because of the increasing amount of tree disease is that the work now is just almost overwhelming and there is way too much for us to do. So I'm sure people will know of examples where actually we have been in and dropped trees and we've just dropped them back into the field that they belong to and we leave them there for the owner to sort out because we've spotted, you know, in ahead of storms that we're likely to lose them, and losing trees in an uncontrolled way is significantly dangerous. So this is shifting the thing. We have a limited resource. We can only do so much, and we absolutely need landowners who actually do hold the responsibility in this to step up and take that responsibility.
Well, the other one, and I'm sure that that subject will continue to rumble on in terms of landowners, but we'll move on to harbours. And this is another one where it felt, certainly as a former DOI minister, that the harbours manager was kind of thrown under the bus by the rest of the department. The harbours manager was given the bulk of the blame for the dredging situation in Douglas Harbour. It dates back to the VAT loss, where we had to savagely cut departmental budgets to try and at least cope with the initial £200 million loss. It was assumed that the budget would be reinstated at some point, and this doesn't seem to have happened. So it's a bit harsh on the harbour's manager when actually the budget hasn't been reinstated, perhaps.
I think that's certainly true. We know that the DOI took quite savage cuts and it hasn't been rebuilt. I think the DOI has been probably significantly underfunded for years because departments like education and health make a better, louder claim for funds, and if I was going to repair 50 potholes this year and I put some off till next year, well, they'll get done in next year's budget, and that rolling thing becomes a growing problem effectively. And the concept of a stitch in time saves nine seems to not necessarily underpin how we fund, and dealing with problems now would certainly save us a lot of grief in the future. I think there's no intention to throw harbours officers under the bus necessarily. There are a group of harbours officers. It's all fairly new in the department. There is a dearth of previous records to draw on. Some of the stuff has never been written down, so there's never really been a dredging programme that we can discern anywhere, ploughing through everything that we've got access to. We're committing to that now. I think it's a very open and honest look from the department at what's gone on and what needed to improve. And there are some staff challenges in there. There are some bits that perhaps people hadn't realised needed to fall under their remit and that they needed to pick up on. But actually, because they've just not been done for so many years, there's almost an element of that we've lost the corporate knowledge that underpins some of those. I do think that the current team are committed to improving. I think it's a very brave decision of them to not only take part in that, and I really do appreciate all the candour for the officers that contributed, but I think it's a very brave decision then to publish that along with a list of what they're doing in response to it. I think that shows a department that is willing to learn and is willing to reflect on its problems and to try and address those. So I do have confidence that the officers are kind of on the case, and that the management within the division is pushing things in the right direction. I'm, I suppose, cautious that there may be other things lurking that we haven't yet picked up on, and that's part of a sort of subsequent discussions happening about and what else has been pushed down the line, what else has been postponed, what else might come and catch us up in the future.
Well, one thing that hopefully will catch up with is addressing the housing crisis, which was much discussed in the run up to the last general election. You have a plan. Tell us about it.
So it was announced a few months back as a statement to Tim Ward. Initial thoughts were whether we went to a housing association model in order to allow a housing association to focus on just delivering more housing for us and to make it something that was really targeted. The other part of the housing association model was that you could, if you took, it would be government-owned housing stock, the DOI housing stock, and you put it into the ownership of a company, the company could use that stock to leverage funds against, to take mortgages effectively, and then to reinvest that money in housing. So it was a way of unlocking funding into housing. So there was a report commission from a company called Altair who looked at how housing was delivered and looked at the housing association model and came up with a suggestion of setting up a company, which would be an arm's length company from government, would have no political representation on it. And over a period of a couple of years, we would transfer all of the government housing stock to this company. The Altair estimate for setting up the company was just short of £1 million to create a board of directors and managers that would effectively take the DOI staff out of the civil service and into the company. And there are some concerns about that. Staff don't have the same protection here for your transfer of terms and conditions, so you'd be moving out of being in the public service to being working for a private company. There were also some concerns about the lack of political oversight into that effectively we'd be handing over the, not quite the government silver, but we'd be handing over all the government housing stock to a company that then we had very little sort of direct governance into and very little direction that we could offer. But the Altair report, when it landed, said basically £1 million. Oh, and by the way, we'll need some offices and some vehicles and some tech support, and we need OHR and we need central services. So the costs were probably nudging more towards £1.5 million just to set this up and get it running. And it would be 3 years or so before you could unlock the finance when you conveyed all the houses across. And Treasury looked at it and said, we're not sure you're getting value for money here on spending £1 million to create some directors. And I looked at it was the first meeting I went to as minister, and I sat there and looked at this report and thought, I don't think I can support this. I don't think I could support it politically. I was nervous about a housing association that took away that control, because I am of the firm belief that government is the provider of last resort for some of this housing, and we deal with the difficult to house people for various reasons, whether it's mobility issues and needing accessible houses, which are more expensive to build and maintain, or whether it's people who have personal issues and we need to provide more supported accommodation in an appropriate location.
And you say we do that, but of course DOI does some of that. Douglas Borough Council does a fair amount of that.
The local local commissioners
do, and all the other housing authorities.
Yeah, they all do.
I think why was that not included in this?
So there was never any intention that the local authorities were going to be forced to hand over their housing. There was an offer on the table if they wanted to put their housing into this and not manage housing directly. What we know from our local authorities is they absolutely prize the ability to provide the right housing for their communities, and they take a real pride in doing that. And they, by and large, they do a really good job at it as well. So there was some nervousness from local authorities that this, you know, there would be a housing association created and we'd steal their housing off them in some ways. And
so why did you not? Well, why was it? It doesn't appear, at least, to have been considered. I didn't see it in the Altair report, but then I may not have read all the pages of it. Why was it not felt that you could just transfer the government houses to the larger housing providers in the various parts of the island?
That was a tack that I hadn't commissioned the report, but that was a tack that started out of, actually, no, we were going to keep control of it. And I think part of the reason is, and I was talking to the housing team this morning, is that we know local authorities are still quite selective sometimes about the people that they will house. Whereas we have to find housing for everyone. And there was a worry that we'd end up with a gap then that would be created of people who just wouldn't be housed.
But that
through local authorities
could be easily dealt with through regulation.
We'd have to regulate. The Altair report, I think the bit that I think it missed is it didn't consider any other models. It considered Treasury as a shareholder of an arm's length company. And there's already some nervousness about Treasury as a shareholder of the steam packet, for example. You know, that we see that there's some tension there in how do you ensure that that government-owned entity meets the political needs of the government at the time. But what the Altair report didn't consider was whether you could set it up as a charity or whether you could set it up as a statutory board and get it running on a not-for-profit basis. There was a we'll create a company model was the only one that they looked at, and it wasn't sustainable. My other challenge on that was actually uplifting and extracting housing from the DOI was going to cause significant instability within the DOI because of how everything is so set up and interconnected at the moment. So my interim solution to this is that we've gone down the model of making housing standalone and creating a housing agency that sits within DOI, that has direct political oversight, chairing the board, putting a board structure in that allows us to invite external sector experts in to, I was going to say check and challenge, but like the critical friend role, to help direct and to evolve our housing. And when I talked to the DOI housing officers and said, why, you know, what are we doing? Where are we up to? Why are we not building new housing? The sort of, and it probably goes back to the time of cutting budgets and everything like that, is we don't do that anymore. We lost the development officer role a long while ago. We've not had anyone on the lookout for how do we expand, how do we adapt our stock in a way that fits what our current demographics are and our current demand is. So rather than spending £1 million to do that, I could see that actually we had scope within the DOI to move roles around and to start to address that ourselves and to put in place better governance, but a better vision for what DOI housing should be delivering.
Next week, obviously, is the we'll be entering the month, which is a year before the next general election. The it's arguable that the whole point of the Chief Minister establishing a Housing and Communities Board was to deliver what your housing agency is set up to deliver. That would appear not to have succeeded. I mean, it's produced several reports and policy documents, but it doesn't appear to have delivered that many houses. Why is your housing agency going to be any different?
I think I think the Housing Communities Board have done a good job. You're right, they have to give a significant piece of work. Things like the Objective Assessment of Housing Need is a really valuable document. They have done significant work into homelessness and how to deal with the homelessness problem and what that looks like. And I think there continues to be a role for the Housing and Communities Board. What was happening was lots of policy decisions there were being kind of thrown towards the DOI to try and deliver that, and actually it was taking us away from our core function, which is to be a really good landlord to as many people as we can. And if you just take that as a sort of a core function of what should the DOI housing be delivering, we needed to focus on that. And there was almost a blurring of the lines that you had Housing Communities Board asking for things from officers that was diverting them away from the day job. So we've kind of, by ring fencing them within the department and ring fencing them and putting better governance to advise them, we're drawing a little bit of a distinction between Housing Communities Board will carry on getting the data and assessing the need and working up those wider policies, whereas we'll be focusing on our allocation policies and what thresholds look like, whether we can introduce rent to buy, which I'm really keen on seeing come forward, how we improve the first time buyer schemes and what the thresholds look like for that, so that we can expand eligibility for that, because we have first time buyers properties that are coming up for being available shortly. So we need to focus on trying to get people into homes, and that needs to be our absolute clear focus.
And that's been said by ministers of DOI, and there have been a few since the general election. That's been said by them. It's been said by the chair of the Housing and Communities Board. It's been said pretty much by every politician, every MHK at least, that was elected at the 2021 general election. Why should we believe you if it's not too brutal a question?
That's harsh. I think there are a number of things. I've sat there and looked, and the Housing Association was meant to unlock some funding, but you would unlock funding in 3 years' time, and we've got Section 13 funds that just haven't been used because we didn't have a development
and
officer to
use. Section 13 funds.
So when a developer builds a housing development, they have to have a certain proportion of that either has to be affordable housing, or they can opt to pay us the equivalent sum in money, and that sits in account basically. And then we can choose to spend that money on an affordable housing project of our choice. And that comes down to DOI housing. But if you don't have a development officer in place looking for these developments, you never spend that fund. It has around about 7 million in it at the moment, and we haven't, haven't really touched it because we haven't really accessed that money in a way to try and provide more affordable housing. And I think it's just a lack of people driving these. Obviously, within the DOI, we have the project management unit as well. We've got a number of people in there who we can treat housing as the client, if you like, and just task them with getting on and managing these sort of larger projects and things. And we've had some really exciting discussions about refurbishing buildings and getting buildings that are out of use back into use for housing, and whether we convert buildings from offices into apartments for city centre living. There are lots of options that we can do to try and start providing more housing stock, because I think the clear outcome from the assessment of housing need was just we need more houses, and in some respects whatever we provide at this stage will be a step forward from where we were. And I'm not necessarily focused, there are some hard to house groups that we need to have some specific plans around, but actually more housing generally is what we need to do. We've got long waiting lists, we've got some people who've been sat there for years. Some of that is dealt with by sorting out our allocation policies, which is a piece of work that's already underway in the department. And then, trying to expand so that people can get into ultimately owning their own home through rent to buy schemes is a really key feature for us.
It is fair to say that as a minister, DOI tends to be where you are most beleaguered. Health Minister might argue otherwise at the moment, but it's certainly a very difficult and very public area to be. You do appear, since you were appointed as DOI Minister, and you haven't managed a year in office yet, but you have appeared at least to take these things on and try and get things delivered. And yeah, it is a bit harsh of me to mention that several other politicians have said what you've just said, maybe I should give you some credit for trying at least to deliver.
Well, yeah, no, some credit for trying would be nice. I think the key thing to understand about where the housing agency sits is that actually that is just the first step in. And we've talked about DOI reform for years. You're right, it's a big, diverse department. And we've tried to see if some of those functions sit elsewhere in government, and certain things have moved. Port security moved to the Department of Home Affairs. Non-emergency patient transport is moving back to Manx Care to govern. That's fine. But the rest of everything doesn't sit. So you're left with a conundrum that isn't just about reform. Doesn't mean just cut headcount. We've talked about the dangers of cutting headcount already, and that, you know, we're kind of pared back to the absolute minimum. We are forced into working efficiently and trying to do things as much as we can with a limited budget, just by the circumstances that we're in. But how do you govern and control and make good decisions within a department that includes so many disparate elements requires you to think about that governance model and structure. So having the agency board effectively coming up with a plan for that housing agency for the next year and what their budget request looks like. We'll go into bat as the department for the budget, but actually once we've got that budget agreed, they've already given us their plan of what we're doing, so we don't need all those decisions to always then keep coming back to the board. So we're kind of streamlining governance, keeping it where it is, so you've got those sector experts advising at agency board level to make sure that, you know, things are being done in a sane and sensible way. You can take two views on it. I'm quite collegiate in how I manage and organise stuff, or I'm not brave enough to make the decision on my own and I want some experts in the room. Either way, it doesn't matter. The end result is that you have a number of expert voices in the room. So you have a politician in there who is going to understand the political pressures on them, and you're going to have those sectors. And actually that model will apply to several bits of DOI by the time we've got through reform. So we're working to restructure it. That takes your decision making back down to the level it should be at. If you're the director of a division, you should be capable of making some of these decisions. It shouldn't always be centralised. And I know from my discussions with officers in the department, they'll say, oh, well, I handed things into central DOI, and it just disappears onto somebody's desk for ages. And sometimes, like particularly with projects, you can see stages of projects and updates and projects. I can see the same project come across my desk four times for signature, but I agreed with it on the first time it came across my desk, and I don't need to see it coming back a further three times unless something has deviated massively in terms of scope or time frame or finance on it. So actually I need kind of reporting by exception, because you've already agreed it's going to go ahead. So there's DOI reform is not as simple as just cutting headcount and working out what we should and shouldn't do. It's actually about how do you make it work.
Yeah, and with housing, it's never been about the money, because ideally, if it's run as efficiently as possible, you should, through the rent paid, you should be able to cover the administration effective housing unit.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I think it's slightly worse than that. We did have a Timwell question in, and the amount that we collect in rents is less than we spend on housing. And to my mind, that's an almost immoral position to be in, that if you have people paying public sector rent into your housing thing, then that money should be ring-fenced for public sector rent. Now, because it's so enmeshed in the department at the moment, that money comes into the department budgets, and so that's part of the work that we're doing, is to actually say, well, you know, if we can ring fence this and we can wean the rest of the department off of that finance, and that's for us to work out how those bits are funded. If we can actually then just say that money stays within there, you will be reinvesting every year. You'll be able to expand your housing stock just from what you're doing. So that rent that we already collect covers our maintenance. You know, are we hitting the right maintenance levels on all the houses? We are on most of them, but we have some significant challenges in some of the really older properties, especially those that have been occupied for a very long time, and then, you know, the tenant finally goes into sheltered housing or a home, and in 40 years, you know, nothing's happened to the house. So there are some real challenges for some of our older housing stock coming up there. But we should, if we can keep that boxed in, that housing fund should become self-sustainable within the housing sector.
I hate to drag us back to local authorities, and I will declare an interest. I am a clerk to the smallest housing authority. Aubrey and Rushen only have four public sector houses. But effectively, everything that a housing authority, local authority housing authority does, has to, by law, be paid for through the rents collected. And all the other housing authorities in the Isle of Man operate in that way, all the local authorities do. And basically what you're saying is, at the moment, DOI doesn't. So going back to an earlier question, why would you not?
Because a lot of the local authorities are claiming housing deficiency. There's only Onchan that operates entirely within its own. In fact, everyone else is claiming housing deficiency.
And Arbery and Rushen don't.
Arbery and Rushen don't. on your four properties, yeah. But, you know, the larger housing things, everyone's claiming housing deficiency. And this is one of our challenges as well, is housing efficiency has just grown year on year. So the housing deficiency fund has now moved from DOI and is now a treasury held fund, because the rise in interest rates over the last few years put so much pressure on that fund. There just wasn't enough money in there to cover what was owed. And I know, because I've sat on local authorities and I've been in local authority meetings when they've been discussing, you know, what should the rent increase be next year, and you'll have people say, well, I want a 0% rent increase for our tenants, because let's face it, housing deficiency will just make up the gap, like it's somebody's, you know, endless pot of money over there that we're going to keep drawing. And actually, we have to move to a model where housing is sustainable, that is likely to see rent levels change. Those that are on very limited income will see the benefit system pick up a little bit more of that than they used to, and those that can afford to pay more will end up paying a little bit more for the, but we need to get it onto, we can't carry on growing the housing deficiency fund every year, because that's effectively a subsidy that comes out of taxpayers' money every single year into that. And for some of those tenants, they're not necessarily the people who are in the greatest need of housing. So we do have to refocus and make sure we've got the right people in public sector housing.
I know that between yourselves in DOI and Treasury, you have looked at ways in which you can reform housing deficiency payments. I mean, to me, it always seemed as though housing deficiency payments should be a top-up towards payment of capital costs. So it's really to cover loans. If that's the case, then, you know, the reason Onchan is no longer benefiting from housing deficiency is either its loans are paid off or it's able to pay from within existing resource. But through the system, it's not encouraged then to use the money that... I mean, and again, I'm second-guessing Onchan here, so apologies if I'm getting this wrong, but the encouragement is not there perhaps for them to develop new property. And maybe something needs to be changed in housing deficiency payments that would encourage that.
I think there's that. We've gone out to all the local authorities recently and we've asked them about what the housing plan looks like. It's actually a statutory requirement that they have a housing plan, and I think it was a surprise perhaps to some of them. And this is where you talk about that sort of churn and loss of corporate knowledge. You know, perhaps the clerks of 20 years ago knew that everyone should have a housing development plan, and somewhere along the line that's been lost. It didn't happen. Documents weren't renewed. Department didn't ask to see them. Nobody knows that they should be there. You've had, you know, significant number of elections since then, so the commissioners are relatively new. So some things like that just fall away. Now, the result of asking that is actually it's prompted a number of local authorities to say, well, we've been considering this and we could do this. And we're actually encouraging them to step forward and say, OK, well, what can you deliver? You know, you've got long waiting lists. And it's part of a more open and proactive dialogue that we're having with local authorities over housing. Whereas I think that I remember going to a, I know if you did a housing conference, so, you know, like years ago, I remember going to one when I was a commissioner, and then that seemed to just fall away. It's almost like we've, even though, you know, you'll tell me that housing is an important issue. I know housing is an important issue when I talk to my constituents, and we seem to have just kind of, I don't know, stepped away from actually trying to deal with it. And I think, you know, I suppose the other part of churn is that the DOI, I'm the fifth DOI minister, you know, within this administration. That's a significant turnover of people. One of those was the chief minister for 6 months. So, trying to do both jobs is a really tough challenge. And there isn't the time to pick up some of that hard to do stuff and to start tackling it. But you're right, I'm a kind of person of action. And the hard problems are the ones that you kind of really need to get stuck in and start chipping away at. And you can sit back and think, well, what does a perfect... I'm never going to find a perfect solution. And if I wait for perfect, it just won't happen. But actually making progress in the right direction is what I'm aiming to do.
And you will, if offices remain the same, you will, as a minister with a relatively short time left before the next election, be being advised, well, minister, it'll take a lot longer than the next 12 months, and it's probably best to leave it until the next minister comes in. I always resisted those suggestions and said, well, no, I've got I've got whatever time ahead, and I'm going to crack on with this.
It's a bit longer than a year as minister, and because I'll have to wait for a new minister to appear before I'm not minister any longer. I see some of my colleagues who are definitely into election mode already, and maybe I'm a poor politician because I'm not interested in getting into election mode. I'm interested in getting on and trying to solve some of the problems. And you're right, you can describe me as a beleaguered minister. There are a number of difficult things.
I would describe challenging. All DOI ministers as beleaguered.
Yeah, but no, that's fine. It comes with the territory. I knew when I took the role that it was going to be a tough one to do, and I know that it's one that proves a challenge for whoever sits in that seat, just because there's so much going on. There is a lot moving forward, and there's a lot of positive stuff happening, and I am pushing, I know I'm pushing officers to try and deliver more and to move things forward, and I'm not intending to stop pushing because somewhere in September next year there's an election looming. I actually want to be able to say to people, look, I did something, I achieved, I moved this on, I've moved it forward, I've got as far as planning permission on this, or I've got funding in place for that, so that, you know, that those things, once you get to the point where you've got the Treasury funding, the project will just then roll on. It doesn't necessarily need me as minister pushing it. It will roll on and happen anyway.
And who knows? You may succeed at the general election and you may end up back in DOI.
Well, there's two big ifs in there, yes. Isn't there? I fully intend to stand for the next election. I make no bones about that, and I've never said anything different. I absolutely love doing this job. The intellectual challenge of dealing with the portfolio of issues that I have to deal with, I find absolutely really sort of inspires me. And I put in way too many hours in a week and things like that, but it's the maddest job I've ever done, but it's brilliant. I hope to be re-elected. If I ended up as being offered the chance to be DOI minister again, I would quite happily step back there. I will leave with unfinished business, but I also have a great vision of where it could be and how you can make this kind of department of bits work more functionally and you smooth the lines of communication and make your decision making faster and enable officers and empower them to make their decisions so that you can get on and you can deliver better services, you know, for the people of the island. And I think infrastructure is one of those departments. It just touches everyone's lives every day. You know, you come out and you walk across the pavement and onto the road and the streetlights are on and all of those, you know, things that start to like coalesce. Every single thing that we do touches everyone's lives, and we get most of it right all the time. And then the bits we don't, it's always headline news. But the bits we don't are tiny compared to the bits we do.
And unfortunately, because it's generally, I mean, unlike perhaps medicine, where I think most people give credit to doctors that they actually know what what they're talking about, and they are generally very well qualified and in a position to speak with authority. Perhaps it's not quite the same with highways engineers or housing officers or whoever it may be, and the public generally think that they're experts on things that they can see and possibly understand a bit better.
Yeah, I think it's always more complicated than the public give it credit for. You know, you'll see the headline come out and you'll see a news article, and you kind of limit the number of words you put in a news press release because there are only so many words that people are going to bother reading. In fact, I don't think sometimes they even read the article that goes with it before they've made a comment. And you're right, everyone thinks they're an expert, usually probably not in full possession of all the facts. And you know, part of our role as politicians when we're presented with this is to test those options we've been presented with, to check the information that backs it up, to look at the evidence, to challenge that, and to really push officers who are experts in their field, but you need to try and draw out what's the best. And sometimes it's not about making the very best decision, it's about making the least worst decision.
And of course, the other thing about experts in your field, you can be an expert in your field, but if you are not driven in a particular direction by a political lead, you will do what you think is best, and it is down to that political drive to make things happen. And I guess this is as well, this is how this housing agency is going to be different, perhaps. I mean, you alluded to, well, you made very clear about the churn of ministers in DOI over the course of the last of this administration. Perhaps if the housing agency remains consistent and has independent advisers sitting on it, there's more chance of policy not having to start from scratch every time a new minister comes in.
Yeah, the anticipation for the agency model is, you know, they would give us their plan and they run with it. Actually, their plan that they give us this time next year will run, and it will span over the election, and it will still be running, you know, into 2027. And so you're right, it's about providing that continuity of direction. There could be a politician who comes in who says, well, actually, we're completely going to change tack on this. I think it's unlikely if you can show that you've got genuinely good decision making with experts. The Chief Minister spoke a while ago about the importance of having, he described them as NEDs, but having them in at department board level. And I think I generally agree with that. I like the idea of having, but how on with DOI, how on earth would you put somebody who is an expert in it? Because if they were an expert in housing, they would be completely irrelevant for a discussion about buses or rail or harbours or the airport or flood management or the weather stations, you know. So you need to put your experts in at the right level to provide that. And this is partly, you know, the reason for going down this kind of agency style model. I did speak with Mrs. Paul Wilson at DHA, and she said, well, I suppose, you know, really I've got the fire brigade operate as their own little entity, and the police operate as their own little entity, and they all have their governance and stuff, and you know, what comes into the department then, actually, it's kind of similar model to that, really.
And particularly
allowing
for
people to be their experts.
Yeah, particularly for the police force, it's really important that they do not operate under some level of political control, because quite frankly, the accusation is that we have a state-run police force.
Yeah, no, I think there are different ways, aren't there, of setting up your department and looking at governance. And when I first became minister, I thought, oh, what do I know about this? But actually, I realised I'd been in four government departments by the time I went in. And then there's an opportunity then to sort of cherry pick the bits that you can see work well. And I've done quite a lot of reflection on how do you manage, you know, large organisations where it's such disparate entities at times. And there is some crosstalk between them, you know, floods talk to highways a lot, and so you can see where things do link together. But those links happen almost on a sort of formal level anyway. But how do we make those officers, you know, get on and do the jobs within their envelope rather than distracting them with pulling them into other things? And I think it is about that focus.
Is there a conversation taking place in government about funding for DOI? I mean, there's always conversations about funding, but is there a serious conversation that recognises that probably the most savagely hit department of government is the DOI, and ultimately, you know, what part at least of the reason why DOI gets so much flack is because it really isn't funded properly to deliver what it's required to deliver.
Yeah, I think that conversation has already been ongoing and stuff. And obviously, I'm lucky enough to have come out of Treasury to come and take this role anyway. So I have had fairly regular conversations with Treasury. We have meetings coming up about how our capital funds are being managed and how we manage those projects through and how we deliver on those as well. So there are a number of discussions ongoing and recognition that actually, you know, DOI has been under some stress for some time. It's the bit you can kick down the road, isn't it? You get a clamour for more dentists or more teachers or whatever, and those things attract the funding. But actually, as I've said, you know, infrastructure hits everyone's lives. I don't see a doctor more than, you know, maybe once or twice a year if I'm unlucky enough to need to see one. So I'm not using the health service all the time, but I am using the roads all the time, and I am parking my car, and I am getting on the ferry or getting on flights. So
and paying for the privilege of parking your car now.
Yes, trying to pay for the privilege of my parking. Yes, I expected to after I was elected, and they asked me to sign a form to pay for it. I expected to pay for it then, and I still expect to pay for it now.
looking then back to housing, I attended a wonderful housing, and I would say, yes, wonderful housing conference organised by your department as a housing provider. At that conference, there was various discussion about what were the hindrances that and the obstacles to building houses that local authorities saw, and many of those seemed to stem from government processes, perhaps not sufficient, not enough human resource in place, and not enough easy access to the funding. By the time you finally get a funding approved, potentially you can add an extra few hundred thousand, maybe even millions, onto the cost of a project because it's taken so long to get through the process. Presumably, that is something that you and Treasury are looking at.
Yeah, I think there's a number of issues, isn't there? If you take it from a local authority perspective, we see a variety of standards of business cases being put forward, and some of them are incomplete in some major details. And yeah, I think we could provide perhaps better guidance to local authorities for, you know, almost a checklist of have you included all the following to make sure that when stuff comes in, we don't spend, you know, weeks doing sort of backwards and forwards with it in order to get that into an appropriate form that we can take it forward. Then there's the how quickly do we deal with that within the department? There's how quickly does it go through Treasury processes? And so I am due to meet with the Treasury Minister fairly imminently to look at how do we smooth that through. And you can see why, in light of previous experiences, why we're cautious about where capital expenditure is going and whether the cost in those projects are actually right or not. And lots of discussions about, you know, what should the level of contingency be, for example. But we also know that if we take too long in that process, we get beyond the point where, you know, if we've gone out to tender, the price is no longer valid because we asked them to hold the price for 120 days. And if we can't process the price in the bid in 120 days and agree to it, then that price falls away and we'll have to go back out to tender again. And so that sort of procurement element of it can really slow things down and can create problems as well. So I think almost across the board, right from inception to sign off, there are challenges all the way through that. So it is one of the, in fact, I had quite a long discussion about it this morning. How do we unblock that? How do we smooth that through? How do we make sure that we still have good oversight? We still have good governance around it, but how do we make those processes work faster? And even if it comes down to saying to officers, right, if this lands on your desk, you've got 5 working days. If you haven't, you know, if you can't do it in the 5 working days, make sure there's somebody else who's going to be picking up on it for you. How do we make sure that we could say to a local authority, from the moment you give us a compliant bid, we can tell you you're going to have an answer in 8 weeks' time or whatever our target time is. And in some ways, that's a bit of a customer services kind of thing from us. How do we commit? So you know, as a local authority, when that bid comes through, right, well, in 2 months I can expect to hear back and then I can move on. And that helps you plan in terms of where you're going as well. And we seem to have we've ended up with lots of convoluted systems and paper goes this way, that way, backwards and forwards. I was going to break into Over the Irish Sea then. we've ended up with the paper moves around and around and around. But it, from your perspective as a local authority, it disappears into some black hole. And eventually somebody might talk to you and you might chase them up in a few months and you might chase them up in a few months after that. And eventually something might appear back. I have challenged the department and said, right, how many petitions are we sitting on here? Find me everything we're sat on and tell me why we're not progressing and you know what we're doing. And we've got a tracking system now for them coming through so that we know where everything is up to and we can actually kind of keep on top of that. But we do need to do better, I agree.
Well, you've said you are a minister that likes to get things done. You're not going to be inhibited by the prospect of an election looming in a year's time. You are going to tackle things and try and deliver. What can voters in Rushen, and I suppose voters across the Isle of Man, but specifically, or particularly voters in Rushen in your case, what can they expect to see delivered over the course of the next 12 months, particularly in relation to housing?
So for housing, I know that I had the direct discussion both with Port St Mary and Port Erin commissioners about housing developments that they want to bring forward for land that they've got on their books. In fact, I had a really exciting discussion with Port Erin commissioners, and we've kind of without seeing the full business case yet, you know, I think there's some real prospects that they're going to deliver there. And there's the long-standing issues around St Catherine's Terrace as well. And I think we've pretty much agreed on what the way forward is for what work needs to be done there as well. So it's down to them now to do the groundworks and get that in. With Ports Mary, I've been talking to the commissioners there as well. They've got some land that they want to try and unlock, and it involves moving various things around, but actually I'm quite sort of heartened by both those conversations. Ports of Mary High Street surveys start next week. I'm just trying to think where we are. Yeah, next week. And so that's the ground penetrating radar survey that will allow me to get the final business case into Treasury. The funding is sat there to deliver that reconstruction of the High Street as well. And that's been a problem before I was on the commissioners.
Are there going to be any planters included?
No
daffodils.
No, they won't let me put any planters in. No rotten things. Well, if they did, they'd probably make me responsible for trimming them as well. So there's no planters to go in. There's some discussion to be had, and there'll be a bit of consultation about which side of the road parking goes, because actually if we move it over the other side of the road, we can get three more parking spaces in. But it'll be up to the residents to decide what they want to do with that road. But it does mean that finally that awful piece of road will be reconstructed. So they'll have seen that. Obviously, delighted that the bus service, the 8S, is now running down and serving Crigneish and the Howe and down to the Sound as well.
Even if it is a minute, it arrives in Port Eyre a minute after the
train
goes.
We need some tweaking. Well, yeah the train will hold just about for the bus and stuff like that. It's not perfect, but if I was going to wait for perfect, I'd still be waiting. So getting something in there and getting it up and running was important. There will be tweaks to timetables that happen as the bus timetables get reviewed twice a year, and the train timetables will be reviewed for next year well.
And so that new service has been very popular from what I understand.
Yeah, and I think I was offered when I first went into the department, and I received the petition and started being lobbied about it. And I had attended the first of the pressure group meetings before I was minister as well. And when I said what's the solution, they'd offered me a little mini bus that would do three times a day service, but just during the week, or a little local hopper bus. And none of those were satisfactory solutions because they weren't sustainable. Whereas the kind of the brilliant thing about having the service 8 is it connects Peel through Foxdale, so the people in Foxdale now have significantly better bus service than they ever did, and it connects them through to the airport, and then you get that improved bit of the service down south as well. So I'm trying to deliver on those bits for Rushen
and the broader island. What are you hoping? But you came on to talk about housing specifically in relation to housing. In 12 months, what should we expect to see?
So in housing, we've got housing coming along online in Jerby. We should see Ballacubbin starting down in Colby as well. And what I'm hoping you see is that we've found some of these conversions to do, which will be relatively quick to deliver and fairly fast to get through planning, and the funding requirement is less as well. And I've got funding sat there that I could spend. So the new development officer is due to start within the next few weeks, and it'll be one of their challenges is to try and start delivering some of that. So I'm hoping that by this time in sort of 6 months I can tell you exactly what's in train and what's out to procurement, what's actually on site and what we're starting to deliver on. And it just need I am confident that the gap between where we are now and where we need to be is so large that anything I can do to start chipping away at that and there's some enthusiasm from the housing officers. When I was down there this morning talking to them, there's some real enthusiasm for what the new vision looks like of trying to deliver more homes for more people and trying to get people in the right home for them. And I'm capitalise on that and enable those staff to go through. And there's some real pride in what they do. And I want to really work with that so that, they can deliver more.
The election obviously is in 12 months' time. Yeah, you've said that you're keen to stand. Will DOI form part of your manifesto, I suppose? Will you be more sympathetic perhaps to DOI than maybe you might have been before you understood the department?
I don't think I've ever been particularly harsh on DOI. I think you have to recognise it as a kind of critical frontline department. But in the same way as we've always recognised health and education as those critical frontline departments, actually, I think this is the one that probably affects more people. It will almost certainly have to, because I'm kind of treading that fine line between being a constituency MHK and making sure I champion my own sector, and I drive through what the constituents of Rushen want and need. But also I have, you know, those national responsibilities to deliver that same sort of development for the rest of the island. And there are a number of projects that will affect the rest of the island as well. So I need to work on those too. I'm going to have to be honest about being a DOI minister in my manifesto, obviously. And I hope that, you know, people see that it's a difficult brief. It's a complicated brief, and there's a number of really challenging things. Some of those things have sat there for years and never really been picked up. And perhaps they'll see that, you know, I've been brave enough or daft enough to say, right, come on, let's see where we can go. Because I firmly believe you don't deliver any change if you just sit there and look at it on your desk. You have to pick it up and start running with it.
That was DOI Minister Michelle Haywood, MHK. So what do you think? Are you prepared to give the Minister the benefit of the doubt and judge her on results in 12 months' time? Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. I'm Phil Gawne, Goramayos and Geisiachrom. Thanks for listening.